Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're actually going to be having a great guest, Christy, Dr. Jim Evans. And he'll be talking about genetics and ethics. And this will actually be the first in what we are going to be presenting a series of shows over the next 2 months with guests and conversations about medical ethics. I'm really excited to get that started today.
I am too. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters.
Yeah, our very first study here, actually from the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, really looks at, you know, we've talked a little bit on our show about the combat and Iraq war and veterans and the increased incidence and rates of depression that they have and sometimes their spouses have and ways of treating that. But one of the things that we haven't talked too much about is this post-traumatic stress disorder and what are ways that we know that we can treat that effectively in some of our veterans.
And the neat thing about this study is it's about telemedicine to see if doing the therapy through video telephone conferencing is as good as in-person delivery of group therapy interventions for people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. And in this, it was more focused on people with anger difficulties.
Yeah, because, you know, reducing anger management and doing that in a group session versus a one-on-one session. And so these patients were randomized to have one or the other treatment. And then looking at the outcomes at all kinds of things about anger and different scales of how that comes out at 3 weeks and 6 weeks, 3 and 6 months after treatment. And what did they see?
And what they found was that the people who participated in both groups, the ones who did the group therapy as well as the ones who did the therapy through the video telephone conference, had significant and meaningful reductions in their anger symptoms. So they did have improvement in their symptoms, and that lasted even beyond the treatment for both groups.
Yeah, and they didn't find any difference in how many people dropped out of treatment, how many people within the treatment did the types of things they were talking about. The satisfaction of the treatment wasn't different. And what I think most important, people didn't have any expectations that really one treatment was going to be worse than the other. I might have had an expectation that the phone treatment might be worse, but apparently these patients did not, and it wasn't borne out.
And it was really encouraging. A lot of these patients live in rural areas. And so I think this showed that using the video teleconferencing method is an effective and feasible way to deliver, you know, care and therapy for patients who perhaps have a harder time driving to their appointment. So yeah, I think it's good to think outside the box.
We've been talking about telemedicine now, Christy, for a number of months
in
all
have.
Different ways, and I think it's going to keep happening. So let's bring it on. What's our next research that matters?
Okay, our next two studies are both about things that we see in the movies, and particularly things that are geared that our children may see in movies. The first one's about tobacco and alcohol and other risk behaviors that show up in movies and how well the ratings that the Motion Picture Associations of America, those ratings that they give of R, PG, PG-13, and G, how much do they really distinguish the content that's in those movies?
Well, and this first article that was in the Journal of Health Communications really showed that it maybe wasn't too strongly predictive, though the R-rated movies did have more tobacco and alcohol content than perhaps the PG rated movies, so that there was more of that, but that the PG rated movies had significant amounts. Now, they didn't talk about the G-rated movies, and I actually did research, Christy, 15 years ago that showed that G-rated movies almost half the time have tobacco and alcohol content. So
it's remarkable.
I'm not so certain that I would rely on those ratings for really whether or not tobacco and alcohol, which is shown pretty frequently in these movies, is reliable information.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed now that I have small children, I'm paying attention to this. And from knowing your research, Adam, I'm really, really struck by how much is shown to our children and really advertised to them through the movies. So
yeah, and there's been calls for really putting the tobacco and alcohol times in movies, some indicator of that into the rating system so that you can actually see not just violence and sexual content and tobacco and alcohol. And so increasingly, that's what we're going to be looking at. And you can make an educated decision, which I think most of us would like to know if there's a two-minute alcohol sequence in a G-rated movie or a four-minute sequence in a PG movie or a six-minute sequence in our movie, we can decide, really, is that something we want, or at least have conversations with our children about what we're looking at.
Absolutely. And the next study is also related. It's about how common it is to have food and beverage brands placed in the movies as using movies as advertising targeted towards children.
Yeah, this was in the journal Pediatrics, and they looked at 200 movies over from 1996 to 2005, and they found that almost 70% contained one food, beverage, or retail establishment brand identified in the movies.
And the movies that were rated PG-13 and R were significantly more likely to have these brands placed in the movies compared with those that were in other rating categories.
Yeah, and whereas they say that, I do see a difference here, Christy, though, myself personally, in these are brand placements, and the difference between tobacco and alcohol, which are illegal for youth,
right,
and which, when used as intended, frequently kill them, than many of these other products that are not necessarily the same way. So I personally see a difference. In addition, which our kids are exposed to advertising
everywhere.
I pulled down the tray in my airline recently in the seat, the tray that comes down, and there's a full page ads there. So I do think there is some difference here. So I wasn't so shocked as much by this. I don't know
right.
about you.
No, I agree that this isn't as profound as the tobacco and alcohol, but I was impressed that in terms of the food brands that were placed on these things, 26% of them were candy and salty snacks, 21% were salty snacks and sugar sweetened beverages. So, you know, there are these subtle ways that we're promoting our obesity epidemic,
in
the movies.
And not so subtle, because what happened right before you came and sat down at your seat in the theater? You went and got your popcorn with your
Coke.
Butter and your candy and your Coke and slushy. So I think that message is kind of right front and center. But what about our very last research that matters?
Our last research is about the topic we're going to touch on today, about genetics-related research. And this was an investigation that was published in the Journal of Medical Ethics from a study done at the University of Edinburgh to look at what are patients' motivations for participating in genetics-related research?
Yeah, no, they looked at 59 patients who had some family history of cancer and really asked them about why they actually might participate in research studies and came up with some really interesting, this is what's called qualitative research. So they didn't do this quantitative survey and then add them up on hundreds and thousands, but they did interviews with these people to really understand better why people might participate, why they may not participate, and to use that information to help advance the field of genetics research.
Yeah. So the three categories that they came up with that really identified patients' motivations for participating in this research were the first one was social. So where the person joins the research study in order to contribute to society and sort of progress science and the benefit of everyone.
We want to reduce the rate of breast cancer among all women who have breast cancer.
Right. I want to contribute to society. And the second one is for family reasons, thinking that their participation in research might improve things for their family or for future generations of their particular family.
So my mother had breast cancer. My sister had breast cancer. We need to really find out the genetics of our family to help really reduce breast cancer in our family.
Yes. And the final one was a personal reason. So where they felt like, well, it either gives me an option for treatment that might help me in my condition, or it gives me a certain personal satisfaction or sense of health that I am participating in this research.
So my mother's had breast cancer, and I really need to know whether or not I need to have a breast removed, and I want to get a genetic testing done to see if I'm really high risk for breast cancer myself.
Sure.
And then what did they find in terms of understanding how these three different motivations, they don't happen in isolation of each other, do they? They seem to working together.
Right. Well, and I think with most things that are this complex and thinking about your health and something that's genetic that could affect your family, that there would be multiple reasons that all sort of intertwine into one another. And so it is more complex than just one reason for most people.
Yeah, and I think what will be interesting is we can have a conversation with our guest today, Dr. Evans, about how they actually go about really enlisting people in trials and what that's about, because it sounds like that this real social need is what really drives people to want to participate.
Mm-hmm. So we've had a chance to talk about telemedicine, to talk about movies with tobacco and alcohol and other
sugar, and looking at people's reasons for participating in genetic-related research.
Mm-hmm. So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jim Evans about genetics and ethics. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And today on Conversations, Christy and I are really excited because this is the first of what will be a series of shows talking about medical ethics. And our very first one is one that we've been wanting to do for quite a long time with a guest that we've been wanting to have for quite a long time, Dr. Jim Evans, about genetics and ethics. And we have so many questions that we want to get to. I'm not going to say anything more and let Christy go right to introducing our guest.
Yeah, we are happy to have you with us today. We'd like to welcome Dr. Jim Evans. Dr. Evans directs the Adult Cancer Genetics Services and the Bryson Program in Human Genetics at UNC Chapel Hill. He is Editor-in-Chief of Genetics in Medicine, the official journal of the American College of Medical Genetics. He received his MD and PhD from the University of Kansas, and he served as resident and chief resident of internal medicine here at UNC. He trained in medical genetics at the University of Washington in Seattle before returning back to Chapel Hill. Dr. Evans is an advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services on the subject of genetics, health, and society, and he's been actively involved nationally and even internationally in teaching high court judges about genetic and scientific matters. So among his many research interests are cancer genetics and the broad issue of how genetic information is used. We are so glad to have you with us, Dr. Evans.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And let's just start out maybe helping our listeners understand fully. When we talk about medical genetics, let's define this, the scope. You know, what are we including in there? And how did you get interested in this? You know, are medical geneticists born or do they happen?
I think we're mutants. Basically, we've, over the past decade or two, begun to gain great insight into the genetic basis of both health and disease. Medical geneticists are physicians who try to help individuals and families with diseases that either run in families or are due to problems with their genes. Those can range from birth defects to disorders that put an individual, for example, at a high risk of cancer, which is something that I see a lot of. Individuals who are, say, predisposed to a particular type of cancer. And with the increase in technology and our increasing insight into the human genome, you've heard about the Human Genome Project, we're beginning to figure out how our genes affect diseases we might be subject to, how they might affect, for example, what medicines would be safe for you or unsafe or that you might respond to better than other medicines. So there's a lot of promise in harnessing some of this technology.
And how did you get interested in this?
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in genetics. I guess because it is a window, it's a glimpse into who we are at a very fundamental level. And I would hasten to add that we are far more than just genetics. We're far more than just our genes. We're the products of our environment, our upbringing, of pure chance. But by the same token, we're also products of our genetics. And anyone who has ever known a set of identical twins, for example, can testify to the importance of genetics in who we are, from what we look like to our interests, right? And it's always been fascinating to me that we've begun to understand in some kind of really tractable way what underlies those similarities and those differences in people.
You spoke a bit to the range of genetic tests that are available, and we see it a lot, or I certainly do in prenatal care, of people getting genetic screening during prenatal care, or patients asking about breast cancer, whether or not they have the breast cancer gene or the gene that might predispose them to get breast cancer or ovarian cancer. I even, as a patient, had a doctor suggest maybe I should get genetic testing to see, because my family has so much melanoma, do I have that gene that predisposes? And that leads to other question of how is that information useful? But my question for you really is, with all this huge range, what are the most commonly encountered genetic tests that we're using sort of in everyday medicine that our patients and families might encounter and need to make decisions about?
Yeah, I would say those fall into three rough categories. One is what you mentioned about cancer predisposition, that genetics is slowly making its way into the broader kind of context of medical practice. And one of the places where it's made the greatest inroads is in oncology, the treatment of cancer. We now routinely, commonly do a variety of genetic tests in individuals whose family history or their presentation, right, a type of cancer they may have developed at a young age, for example, might indicate the presence of a mutation, a genetic alteration, that puts them at high risk. And knowing about that, of course, can be of immense help in figuring out how best to take care of them and how to tailor their medical care to their individual situation. But it can also be of great help to family members, right? If a woman has a sister, for example, diagnosed with breast cancer at a young age, it may well be that genetic testing in that family could be tremendously useful in giving her, the sister, a heads up as to her risks. And she could then take preventative action, increase surveillance, etc. Other ways or settings in which an individual might come across the need or the suggested need for a genetic test would be in the newborn screening type of setting. Babies are screened for a variety of disorders. The best known is probably PKU, right? A condition which, if picked up in the first few days of life and then treated with an appropriate dietary intervention, can result in an absolutely normal, wonderful, healthy child who lives a normal, long life. On the other hand, if it's not picked up, it results in devastating problems to that child and the family. So newborn screening is something that's very focused on genetic diseases and is undergoing a real revolution, in the sense that our technology, our ability to diagnose things genetically, is expanding at an unprecedented rate, and we will see more and more of these newborn screening issues coming.
Yeah, I know that there was an article in the New York Times this past weekend about really the large decrease we're starting to see in some of these diseases that, when I was in medical school, were ones you spent so much time studying, because said these could potentially one day be prevented, and here we're doing that. But you know, one of the questions I want to ask, that whole first category of diseases you mentioned about the people getting it and finding out the kind of their risk, is we're talking about ethics here today as well, and aren't there issues that relate to privacy and how that information is utilized and who has access to that information? You go in for life insurance, and you've had this test done because you really want to know your risk, and is that what happens?
Yeah. Well, you touched in those last few sentences on a whole host of huge ethical issues. And genomics has progressed so far and is becoming powerful enough that it does have tremendous ethical implications. So to take a few of those, you mentioned privacy. your genome is a code, right? It's literally a digital code. And it can therefore, in this digital age, be transmitted with great ease. Therefore, when you have genetic tests done, they're very easily transmitted, right? And we have to think carefully about privacy because most people accord their DNA information, their genomic information, a special status. Now, whether they should or not, we could argue all day about. But it is true that people think about genetic tests and their DNA in a different way than they think about their knee X-ray or their EKG. And I would maintain that's probably because we all recognize that at some level, our genomic information does say something very fundamental about who we are.
Well, you know, I think we want to come right back to that because who owns it and mm-hmm. who owns it in a legal sense?
And I think we can get into some of these,
but we're gonna need to take a short break because, boy, we want to keep going here. But when we return, we're going to continue our talking with Dr. Jim Evans about genetics and medical ethics. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Evans about genetics and ethics. And in particular, we were just talking about genetic testing and privacy issues and thinking who owns this information, how private should it be. And I have a conversation fairly regularly with patients who ask me about getting these, you know, various genetic tests and trying to determine questions about what will that mean to know that information? Who might see it? Could they be denied insurance in the future because they have a pre-existing condition? And I wonder if you could speak to that and,
sure.
and
well,
what you see.
Those are really good questions and questions that have been on people's mind for a long time. There is some very good news on that front, and that is that just last year, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act was finally passed and signed into law after over a dozen years of trying and lobbying. And it does some very important things. It most significantly, it makes it illegal for your genetic information to be used in the healthcare arena, right, for medical insurance, mm-hmm. or in the employment arena. In other words, genetic information cannot be used to set rates, to deny you or make coverage decisions. It cannot be used in hiring or firing decisions. And that's all very good.
It's great news.
Yeah. On the other hand, it is not it is not a completely idle question, even in the setting of GINA, that act having passed, because there is no protection against, for example, discrimination in the realm of life insurance, long-term care insurance, or disability insurance. So we do have to still think carefully about an individual and the possible impact, say, on disability insurance before doing certain genetic tests that might indicate a very high risk of developing some condition.
I mean, does an individual have to disclose when they go for life insurance they've had a genetic test? Is there any moral or legal ethical consideration to do that?
Well, if they are asked about it, right, and they don't tell the truth, then in retrospect, if the insurance company finds out about it, they can deny the benefits.
So if you have a genetic test for Alzheimer's, which we all hope mm-hmm. that we at some levels, if we had a good treatment for,
there you go. That's okay. Right. You want to know,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And that's a big
but
issue.
You know, we would all take out long term care insurance,
right.
And we'd get it now.
Right.
And
so what you get to is a very important point about this, and the take home message in my mind is we are all mutants, okay? And that sounds kind of funny and that sounds kind of provocative, but it's true.
I mean, we all have an abnormal genetic
test.
Every
single one of us has genetic defects that will have an adverse impact on our health because as far as I can see, nobody is immortal, right? We all have genetic problems. What that argues strongly for in my mind is, since we're all in the same boat, we need to all pool our resources and pool our risks so that we're all protected. Because nobody gets out of the genetic lottery with a completely winning hand.
And there's a different amount of privacy that might be involved in a research study as compared with these businesses who just call you up and say, hey,
right,
we want to.
Well, that's interesting because what you bring up is this blossoming industry of direct-to-consumer genetic testing. You can now send your saliva sample, it doesn't require a blood test, along with your credit card number to a variety of companies who will analyze your genome at a million or 2 million sites. We now are on the verge, on the threshold of you being able to get your entire genome sequenced for a few thousand dollars. The questions, however, start to come up pretty rapidly when one thinks about that. Number one, Brian, you said a second ago, do you want to know if there's nothing you can do about it? I don't really want to know at this point whether I'm at an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease because there's nothing I can do about it. On the other hand, if when the day comes that there is something we can do, then knowing my risk might make sense. Another thing to think about as one considers whether to send your saliva sample in for genetic testing is who's going to have access to that information. I tend to want to maintain some degree of privacy about my medical records, about my genetic information, and yet when I've sent my DNA sample to someone,
to a business,
there's really no telling. There was a recent case of one of the major purveyors of direct-to-consumer genetic testing going bankrupt. And one of the scenarios that could have easily resulted from that is some venture capital firm in Boston would have now owned your genetic information.
Well, right? And I could even imagine scenarios where falling into the wrong hands, where you have extortion and blackmail,
sure,
where someone's saying to a CEO of a large company that would their shareholders like to know that he's at very high risk for a disease.
Yeah, people are very,
driving shareholder value down.
That's right. Look at the recent interest in Steve Jobs and his illness, right? There was huge speculation on that in the business pages. There were probably movements in stock prices, et cetera, that had to do with the health of a single individual. One can imagine genetic information being A, in the wrong hands, but also B, perhaps interpreted in a too generous way, interpreted with the idea that we really know more than we do, that this could have a real adverse impact.
So do you recommend that those quick screened or direct-to-consumer genetic testing, do you recommend that for people or not at this point in time?
Here's what I would tell people about it. It's if they're doing it purely for entertainment purposes, it can be kind of fun, right? I mean, people are interested in what DNA can tell them about their ancestry and where they came from and that kind of thing. And that can be kind of fun if they're looking for it from an entertainment standpoint. But if they're looking for useful medical information, I would tell them that in no uncertain terms that it's pretty much a waste of money. And if they're interested in that, to see a professional, especially a genetic counselor. I work with a lot of genetic counselors, and they are the backbone of the medicine's ability to help people understand their genome. So, and there are, you can find a genetic counselor by going to the National Society of Genetic Counselor websites. I'm not a genetic counselor.
Right, we have excellent ones at UNC.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
And that's the kind of professional or a medical geneticist like myself, mm-hmm, who can help you figure out, are there genetic tests that would be a benefit to me and my family, help you put those risks and benefits in perspective.
And speaking of risks, we've all seen the sci-fi movies of the future of genetic discrimination, where
like Gattaca.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Great movie, actually.
Yeah.
But I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, we all know that our society has undergone many awful things in our past. And so it seems plausible that
could
happen.
Absolutely. And the idea that genetic information or genetic proclivities could be A, distorted and misinterpreted, and B, used against us, we don't need science fiction to show us that. Look at Nazi Germany. Look at the eugenics movement in this country at one time. Genetic information can be misused and can be misinterpreted in ways that harm people. So I think that those movies like Gattaca are actually a wonderful, they're entertaining, mm-hmm. and they are a reasonable cautionary note, because this is powerful technology and powerful knowledge, and we need to try to use it for good and not use it to exclude others, to limit a human's potential, but rather we need to use it to try to benefit us in health and disease.
Well, I know that Christy mentioned at the beginning that you educate judges. And I, you know, maybe one of the last things we can talk about today is really, you know, this is opening up so many more things than we were ever trained to really think about, and the implications, and ranging here from the 20% of the genome is patented now,
right,
in cases and going before judges. And why is it that you actually have to educate judges here?
Well,
what's happening?
I've rarely met a more intelligent and inquisitive group of individuals than judges, okay? But as they will be, you know, the first to tell you, most of them did not have much in the way of scientific background. In fact, many of them will tell you they went into the law because they really didn't like science. And yet now in their courtrooms, they're confronted every day with questions that hinge on science. So I think it's very important that all of us in the medical professions and in science do our part to educate others about science and how it affects us in society.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, and that is about genes being patented.
Right.
Like, how does someone patent a gene as if they created it?
That's
particularly
bizarre.
When they got NIH funding, National Institute of Health funding, public funding,
that's right,
turned into patented objects.
And you know, it's a complex issue.
No.
It's right. It's one that most of us have significant problems with. Those who advocate the patenting of genes will say that we need patent incentives in order to get the life-saving drugs and research that are out there. I would maintain that knowledge about the human genome and about our shared legacy of our genetics is so far upstream. It's so central to the research and the medical field that we should not be carving it up like so much real estate at that stage. We should allow it to be open for research and investigation, and then allow the fruits of it to blossom with downstream innovations that really truly require human inventiveness to be patented, but
well,
not the genes themselves.
Makes a lot of sense.
And that's a great place to, first off, thank you for coming here, sharing some things that are even difficult for Christy and I as providers to really put our arms around and begin to at least do that for us and hopefully for listeners. If there's one place where people can go for more information, is there a website you might recommend?
Sure. If you just Google UNC Genetics, you'll find the genetics website, and there are links to our clinical programs and links to a variety of resources.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Evans of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, about genetics and medical ethics, and we're going to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking about house calls and answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your attitudes towards medical care.
We hope you'll write us about your experiences and questions, and we'll address them on an upcoming show. And we'd like to ask our guest producer, Carol Ripley Moffitt, to say, what are some of the house call questions we have today?
Okay, our first listener says that her grandfather is a smoker, but tries not to smoke around us when we visit him. We thought we were safe, but now I've been hearing about something called third-hand smoke. Can you explain to me what this is, and should I be worried about taking my young children to his house?
Great question, and good for you for paying attention to the information about third-hand smoke.
Well, and the question here, and we all know about secondhand smoke, which is the smoke emitted from idling a cigarette, as well as the smoke emitted from when a smoker exhales. And we know that that is a major cancer-causing agent. And what we're increasingly hearing about now is this third-hand smoke, Christy, which is this term of the residue that settles into the environment and stays there even after the cigarette's been extinguished. We've known this for a long time, that on the wallpaper or the walls or the curtains or the clothes, that you can really strongly smell. And if you can smell it, you're actually inhaling some of that residue. I had someone sitting next to me at a basketball game just the other day who strongly had third-hand smoke on them. And it's not just something that's potentially offensive to the way it smells, but it also actually can be potentially toxic.
And I mean, the particles that are found in this third-hand smoke or in these in the clothes and the hair and the curtains are formed from more than 200 poisonous gases, and many of those are cancer-causing.
Yeah, so the short answer is, should you be worried? I think you should be a parent and do what you think is appropriate and do everything you can to reduce your child's exposure to not only secondhand smoke, but also third-hand smoke. And that might involve maybe reducing the holding time that the grandfather has with your child, unless they change clothes and does other things to eliminate that risk.
Not to mention doing all you can to get them to quit.
Yep.
So great question.
Carol, what's our next house call?
This is a reader who says, I'm going to be traveling to Africa for 3 weeks next month, and I'm worried about traveler's diarrhea. I have a lot of digestive problems as it is and don't want to spend the entire trip feeling miserable. Can you provide any tips? And is there any particular medication that I should take just in case?
Good question. And
excellent,
the answer is
question.
Yes and yes.
Yes.
Do, so, do we need to say what the tips are?
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, we should say the tips really quickly. I mean, they're pretty obvious, but don't eat or drink anything from a street vendor if you can help it.
Yep. Don't eat any food or things from things if you're in a place that appears unclean.
And don't eat meat or seafood that's raw or even appears undercooked.
Yeah. Don't eat some raw vegetables or raw fruits unless you've been able to peel them and you've been able to really, really know that they're safe.
Avoid tap water, avoid ice.
And don't drink or eat unpasteurized dairy products. So those are some general tips. Now, what about some specific tips about traveler's diarrhea?
So traveler's diarrhea is extremely common. And some people take, or you've heard about taking like preventive antibiotics to prevent it. Generally, those aren't recommended unless you have a like an underlying medical condition because there are side effects like being real sensitive to the sun that can injure your skin or even getting diarrhea from the antibiotics. So you want to do that cautiously, but it sounds like you might have some belly problems already, and so it would be worth a conversation with your doctor.
And then some people will take an antibiotic that's prescribed from your physician,
mm-hmm, like Cipro,
like ciprofloxacin, that you can take. Usually, if you have diarrhea that lasts more than 24 hours, and then it can cut down on the duration. Others can take things like Pepto-Bismol or Bismuth-Subsalicylate in a liquid or pill form that can maybe sometimes prevent it.
I know. I saw some data saying that it prevented diarrhea up to 65% of travelers. So that could be helpful to you. Good luck and be careful and wash your hands.
What's our very next house call, Carol?
I recently saw my family doctor and he said that I had high triglycerides, that they were 1,000. My total cholesterol was not that high in the past, though my LDL cholesterol was a little elevated. I feel fine, but my doctor seemed really concerned. Why is there so much concern about this all of a sudden?
Well, I think you've got a good family doc or primary care doctor there if they are concerned about a triglyceride level of 1,000. I would be concerned.
So the triglyceride level is part of the total cholesterol or lipid profile. Normal triglycerides are less than 150, and very high is considered over 500. So if yours are 1,000, those are really significantly high.
Now, and if they haven't been high in the past, that would suggest that you may well be altering your diet in some ways that we could pretty reliably predict, which is pasta and breads and carbohydrates and alcohol, the things that actually raise triglycerides a lot. And a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I've been eating a lot of bread lately.
And I mean, at those levels, that would put you at higher risk for developing pancreatitis, which can be real painful, and also increase your risk for heart disease. And really thinking about wanting to get that down and make sure your cholesterol profile is as optimal as it can be good for you in terms of thinking about reducing your risk over time.
First thing to do, change your diet. Get back to a good diet that you know you need to be on. Get rid of those complex, get rid of those carbohydrates that are driving up, and get it rechecked within 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. There are medications like Gemfibrozil and other medicines that can be helpful as well, and that's probably indicated if yours are that high.
Carol, what's our very last question?
My mother recently had an episode where she started vomiting and had diarrhea that lasted about 3 hours. She got really weak and dizzy, but she refused to go to the ER despite my urging. She has high blood pressure and diabetes, and after several days, she did feel better, though she insisted that it was just a virus. I was really worried, though, and I think she should have been seen. Who was right?
Well, we're not going to get in the middle of this particular argument here. We're going to say that both of you were right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is important if you're having continued diarrhea or vomiting to think about keeping fluids down and seeing the doctor if you're not able to do that. And I can see that you were concerned about your mom, but it sounds like it was pretty short-lived and that she was getting better, and so it's probably okay that she stayed home.
And at the time when she was really weak and dizzy, she could have benefited from some IV fluid, so you were right, too.
Yep. So
that's not too politically correct there, Christy, but that's the way it is.
It is. So we've had a chance to talk about third-hand smoke and traveler's diarrhea.
About high triglycerides and what to do with your diet.
And a little bit about family conflict over when to go to the doctor.
There you go.
So thank you for joining us today for Here's to Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are helpful to you and your health. And we hope that you'll write us to yourhealth@unc.edu to share your questions. And you can follow us on Twitter.
And we'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest producer today, Carol Ripley Moffitt, as well as our guest today, Dr. Jim Evans.
We hope you'll join us next time on Here's to Your Health. And on behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.